Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And what is it going to take? So one of the things I just didn't take time to really, you know, because it's Feedback Friday. I didn't want to waste any time when we were going through content because I editorialize enough as it is. But I find it ironic that when we were hitting these really dangerously low temperatures, I mean, it happens every year, right? So we kind of know that there's going to be a point in time where all of a sudden we go sub-zero, at least where we live. And I think across the northern states of the United States, this happens, okay, as a regular occurrence. So the irony did not, you know, fall short, at least with me, that as we were getting ready to plunge, you know, sub almost minus 20, actually, I think at one point we hit negative 22, but nevertheless, we were sub-zero temperatures for a, you know, a series of days. And as soon as that occurred, our power company sent all of their users an email saying, hey, we have a problem and we may not be able to provide you with natural gas. Now, this is in the state where Jay Inslee has overreached his constitutional powers and has declared that he wants to actually put a war on all other types of fuels that force everybody into electricity. And on top of that, he wants to get rid of the hydroelectric dams. Now, as long as I have been alive, Washington State has been a provider of electricity to the American grid, and California has been one of our biggest consumers. And so apparently, a hydroelectric dam, according to him and his experts, is not necessarily green energy. The only green energy are these monstrosities of solar farms, which, and wind farms, which are, I mean, they're not even good for an alternate source of energy. But anyway, it's not a coincidence that they do these things. They want to at least start creating these fears. Oh, well, we might not have, you know, gas to heat our homes. Now what are we going to do? We're being manipulated. We're being set up in every direction. I don't trust these power companies, these supposedly public utilities, because they're not public. They're not public. And there's no transparency. As a matter of fact, how many of your executives across the United States, all of you that are listening, how many of your public utility executives are making big, huge bonuses for the profits they're bringing in? Profits they're bringing in. In other words, why is it that they're making profits and they've got us in a grid that supposedly, they keep on warning us, oh, it's inadequate. But, oh, by the way, we want everybody to go electric vehicles, electric heating, electric cooking. We want everything to be electric, but it's inadequate. This ought to infuriate you. Well, so we are actually doing things about all of this. So we've got a petition that's coming out that actually goes after the Department of Commerce. We've already got the petition that goes after the Department of Transportation. So now the Department of Commerce and now the Department of Energy, because how did the Department of Energy come to be? It was an offspring from the Department of Commerce. It's just like the EPA. The EPA came off of the, you know, the energy efforts that the federal government was involved in. So what we're doing is we're connecting all the dots. And we're going to create petitions for all of these things, folks. So what's it going to take to get you engaged? What's it going to take? I mean, we're doing all the work for you. As a matter of fact, some of the things we're actually stating to many of the groups, teams, and patriots we're working with. You know, you don't have to work so hard to learn all of this stuff. Just read these petitions and take a stand and deliver these petitions to your county commissioners. We're making it easy to make you look like a James Madison. In other words, it's almost like we're creating the script for you. All you've got to do is fill the shoes. All you've got to do is don the courage to take a stand. How much more can we simplify this for you? Think about it. If there's a way we can make it easier to get you involved, our contact information is right there on reclaimingtherepublic.org. Now, there's a lot of other things that I want to get into, but we really never did change we never did close this concept or this my covering, because I kind of talked about it a little bit on Monday, and I didn't get into the details I wanted to, because bottom line, I've been asked about the Electoral College, and so this is kind of a deep subject to dive into. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to kind of really drill into this historically, because I want everybody to understand that the Electoral College was one of those things that allowed the states to play around and how they wanted to interpret it and misinterpret it and then lead us astray. Because today, folks, you are not actually following the Constitution, and you're not demanding the Constitution be followed in the choosing of the president. Now, I'm going to try not to be repetitive or redundant to what I said last Friday and what I may have mentioned on Monday, but the reason we have an Electoral College is because they understood, first off, they did not want a direct democracy. So they made it impossible for us to have a direct democracy in choosing the leader of the nation. And that's because they didn't want populism to actually take root and democracy to grow. Think about that. They didn't want populism and democracy to grow in America. Now look at look at the history of the last century of presidential elections. It has been completely shifted away from an electoral college, and it's all about the little tyrants, the demagogues that get out there and, you know, use hyperbole and kind of create this narrative. Like Obama, we need change. We need fundamental transformation. And he did. He violated the Constitution in delivering some of that stuff. But he was ambiguous enough to where he didn't really articulate anything other than that, you know, they stood for all of the things that the people wanted that would have been violations like free health care. Here's a man that ran on a presidential campaign. I mean, his platform was, we're going to violate our oath of office. So how is it that this man has not been impeached? How is it? Well, I can tell you, because Congress promised they wouldn't do that. Yeah, he was the first black president. So what? He violated the Constitution. And by the way, we need to impeach all of these other presidents. Even though, I mean, look at Reagan. Reagan campaigned on this promise against Carter that he would actually get rid of the Department of Energy, who actually instituted that department. But what did he do with the Department of Energy? What did he do, you know, going down this path of supposedly answering the campaign or, you know, fulfilling his what we'll call platform promise? He fell short. Now, does Reagan deserve to be impeached? Oh, by the way, folks, impeachment isn't for a sitting president. Impeachment is for removing emoluments from a person receiving them. In other words, impeachment is not a trial of a crime. Impeachment is proving that somebody has done something where they do not deserve the emoluments anymore. You can, you know, the impeachment or the removal of a congressperson. And oh, by the way, because their benefits are for life now. See, when they wrote the Constitution, how many benefits for life did they have? When George Washington retired and then slowly, you know, died, I mean, he died before the end of the century. So he was only out of office for a couple of years. Did he have any emoluments when he left office? No. I'll just say the burden to support a public servant ended when you stepped out of office. So how is it that they created these permanent emoluments without amending the Constitution? Because they've been able to ignore the Constitution, just like with the Electoral College. So just so you understand, Obama can be impeached just like they went after Trump, and they actually pursued Trump in an impeachment. They couldn't pull it off on his, you know, after he was out of office. Bill Clinton should be impeached. I mean, if you need ideas of how to impeach all of these living presidents like Carter, by all means, let me know. I will help you with all of the charges of how they violated their oath by exerting unconstitutional powers. It's time we place the Constitution over your personal interest, over, you know, our differences. It's time we place the Constitution first, because that's the only way we as a nation are going to be able to, you know, unite together on that one issue. And as a matter of fact, we've got to start giving up our little pet issues, whether that be parental rights, whether that be the environment, climate change, chemtrails, whether that be the invasion. It doesn't matter. We have to start giving up, chasing down these rabbit holes that are, you know, clearly they're violations of the Constitution, and we have to just back up and demand full compliance to the Constitution. We need to get rid of these lifetime emoluments for our public servants. They have created a career out of this, and they've really limited the amount of people who serve. And they didn't have the authority to do that either. But the Electoral College, just remember, the Electoral College is directly tied to our representation. In other words, you get one elector for each person that is in Congress, whether it's the Senate or the House of Representatives, you get one elector for each person. So if we actually were following the Constitution, our Electoral College would be somewhere around, well, I'll just, you know, take it based on the current population minus the 50,000 or 50 million invaders. So that's basically less than 300,000. We're just going to round up, because that would be 10,000 for the House of Representatives. And that would be another 100. So it would be 10,100 at an even 300 million. Now, to be clear, they started playing games with how the electors and representatives were tied for apportionment. So what some states tried to do is some states tried to stretch it, the smaller states, so that they could gain a little bit more representation. They tried to, you know, stretch it so that they could actually have more people counted. In other words, all citizens, what have you. But they started peeling that back and they started limiting it. And actually the amount of representations started being reduced, because they realized, and they all got on board with this concept, because it's this little adage. A good friend of mine, John, with Northwest Grassroots, he has this little motto, keep it small, keep it all. Because the more people you add to the pot, the harder it is to control a larger group. And so that's one of the reasons why they actually started playing around with, oh, well, maybe it should only be for adults or citizens or voters. And so I think that what really has to happen, and the only way we're actually going to get to the bottom of all of this, to actually come to a true standard, because when the states finished the Constitutional Convention and they started exercising the Constitution, they didn't establish standards. And the Electoral College and that apportionment of representation was one thing that was kind of glaring in the face of, you know, how is that? Because the Constitution wasn't clear. So they started playing with it and how they could take advantage of it. And that's how it always is, right? Now that you're at the trough of power, now that you have the opportunity, let's make this an advantage for you to kind of protect yourself and keep the people that you don't want in out. Well, as they exercised the first iteration of the Electoral College in 1788, there were five states, Connecticut, Georgia, New Jersey, New York, and South Carolina, where the electors were appointed by the state legislature. Now, to be clear, when you read the Constitution, and actually it's right there in Article 2, Section 1, it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of equal legislators to the whole number of senators and representatives. In other words, in such manner that they have the responsibility of appointing in a manner the electors. They do not have the authority to determine the outcome. As a matter of fact, as we went through the ratification debates, we highlighted how many times that was really told in the state debates, how the Constitution was justified that the people were to choose their electors. Governor Randolph stated this, James Madison. I mean, we had plenty of a testimony in some of the different debates, even up in Massachusetts, where they identified that the people were to choose their electors. We weren't to choose the reason why. Why was that so important? Because everybody knew at this point in time, it was just common knowledge. They created a Republican form of government, and the United States citizens understood why, because the framers put it out to the people that a popular vote and democracy will always send a nation sideways. The only way to preserve liberty and to, you know, to keep government from being so intrusive and so controlling is to keep democracy out of the government. Ergo, they made it so we created an electoral college so that you, the voters, would choose who your elector would be. Now, just imagine this now. Let's say your state legislatures actually took it upon themselves, and I'd love to see this happen, especially in a red state like, let's say, Texas, that has a lot of Republicans, but they do have Democrats going into Congress. Let's say the state of Texas, the state legislature basically made it winner take all for representation as well as your electors. What does that mean? In the election of the representatives, if the majority of the representatives for the state actually are Republican, then they all of the candidates that ran as Republicans in the general election would be then sent to the House of Representatives. In other words, they would then control the outcome of your representation based on popular vote. Now, everybody would say, well, that's just wrong. That's just repugnant. How come nobody has that same comment regarding your elector? When you actually choose an elector, let's say it may be Republican, maybe it's not. Whatever you chose in your congressional district, and then the state legislature says, well, that's okay, we're disregarding what you want, we're going to determine the outcome that it's winner take all. Well, what's the difference? When we look at our representatives, our electors represent our suffrage in choosing the president, and our House of Representatives, those people that we elect to represent us in the House of Representatives, and our suffrage on the issues that they have to deal with. Remember, representatives are those who actually we delegate our suffrage to in government. Now, when we look at, you know, the elector, he only has really one function. What really should have happened is as all of the states went into their constitutional conventions, every state should have embraced this concept of an elector and an electoral college, because it would have taken direct democracy off of the table. And it would have allowed the people to actually choose a representative who would, because then we would all of a sudden realize that we don't have a monarch as a governor, nor do we have a monarch as a president. What we have is a person that was chosen by representatives to do a very specific job, to execute the laws, not to create laws and not to be little petty tyrants like Jay Inslee in Washington State, or even Gordon in Wyoming, or Abbott in Texas. Even though these may be Republicans, they're just as much of a tyrant because they're not following the Constitution. They get away with these violations because everybody likes the other things that they do. And we've got to stop this, folks. We've got to actually start demanding full compliance regardless of, you know, how palatable the violation is. A violation is a violation is a violation. So as we get back into the very first election, these five states again, Connecticut, Georgia, New Jersey, New York, and South Carolina determined the outcome. Massachusetts now, they basically had two electors appointed by the state legislature. In other words, those two electors that were to represent the Senate for suffrage. Now, this makes sense. I'm okay with, you know, dividing it this way because of the Senate being chosen by the state legislature, it only makes sense that because they should have some vote or some say in the suffrage of, you know, those two electors that they receive for the senators, that they parsed it that way, and then that the people in the legislative districts would choose their candidates for, you know, for their congressional districts. In New Hampshire, the elector was chosen by voters statewide. However, if no candidate won a majority, the state legislature then would appoint electors from the top 10 candidates. In other words, who brought in the most votes out of the top 10, because that's how many they had was 10. And so the Virginia and Delaware states divided into electoral districts with one elector chosen per district. So in other words, they had congressional districts and they had elector districts. And the people in New Hampshire, or I should say Virginia and Delaware, the people chose their electors just as it was basically articulated during that ratification debate. In other words, they actually followed the letter of the law of how they described the Constitution, at least in Virginia. Now, Delaware, they didn't even debate the Constitution. Remember, they were the first ones to just rubber stamp it like, you know, like a lap dog. And so Maryland and Pennsylvania, the electors were chosen at large. In other words, it was a statewide vote. They had a big, huge ballot, and they chose their electors statewide. And then in North Carolina, Rhode Island, they didn't choose electors because they had not ratified the Constitution. Now, in 1792, the second presidential election, Kentucky and Virginia, the state was divided into electoral districts. So in other words, Virginia and this new state called Kentucky, because where did Kentucky come from? It came from Virginia. So Kentucky adopted that same process that Virginia was holding to. And so Virginia maintained its position, but apparently Delaware changed, and we'll get to Delaware in just a minute. Maryland and Pennsylvania still did statewide voting. And then Massachusetts had two congressional districts choose five electors each. And then the remaining two. So then, in other words, they really went down this path of getting creative. And they had two congressional districts choose five electors each. And the remaining two districts chose three electors each, chosen by the majority of the voters in congressional districts. If an insufficient number of electors are chosen by majority vote from a congressional district, remaining electors would be appointed by the state legislature. Now, where am I getting all of this information? Actually, folks, you can get this, believe it or not, Wikipedia may not be a great resource, but when it comes to some of this stuff, they actually do a pretty good job. And so all of this stuff is actually in Wikipedia so that you could capture how the choosing of the president was done, because it is important. And so when we come back, we'll cover the rest of the states for the 1792 election. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so basically, New Hampshire kind of went down the same path as Maryland and Pennsylvania, with a statewide vote for all their electors, and then they had some runoffs for the top two vote getters and so forth for the remaining. So in other words, it was a statewide vote, but if there weren't clear winners, then they had these runoffs. And then as we look at Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Rhode Island, South Carolina, and Vermont, each elector was appointed by the state legislature. So in other words, after the very first election, because how many states did this the first time? It was only five states. Now, the other states looked over their shoulder and go, hey, that's pretty smart. The state legislatures got to choose, and they determined the outcome. Let's do this as well. So in other words, they now had nine states instead of five, that the legislatures were dictating the outcome of who the president was going to be. Now, clearly the Constitution doesn't give them the ability to determine the outcome, but they took it upon themselves. Why? Because the states themselves did not demand a standard of how that was to be interpreted. And as a matter of fact, I honestly think that that's just like the apportionment, were two things that they kind of left it go sideways. And so it really opened up this vulnerability down the road to be basically co-opted by the party, because there were no standards. There literally was no standards in the very first two selections of the president. But nobody complained. Why? Because they loved their president. I mean, they had George Washington, the beloved, as their president. So who was looking at the process? When the voters found out, or the people of America found out that George Washington was the president, they said, oh, this is just great. We are so blessed. Ah, but in the next election, in the 1796 election, each elector was appointed by the state legislature in Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Vermont. In other words, it went down to seven, so they reduced it a little bit. And then in Kentucky, Maryland, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Maryland, North Carolina, and Virginia, the state is divided into electoral districts. In other words, the concept of electoral districts started growing, that the people were to choose their president. And basically, this had come from and stemmed originally from Virginia and Delaware. Now, Delaware still stayed in the camp of the little tyrants that we were. I mean, I've told you folks that the problem has always been our state and our state legislature. We have to get them into compliance. Nobody ever focused on the ball, and the ball being the states. Why? Why is the ball the states? Who are the parties to the compact? It's not we the people. It's not your counties. It is our state legislature who is formed by the dignity and sovereignty of your counties. At least all of the new states were, and the old states failed. I mean, anyway, let me, I want to focus on this because I was going to go down the rat hole of talking about how important constitutional counties and having a constitution is. Now, each elector was chosen by voters statewide in Georgia and Pennsylvania. So, in other words, the statewide, you know, election of voters, you know, basically maintained kind of the same, except Maryland kind of moved and Georgia moved into this camp. Maryland moved into dividing the state. But Massachusetts, again, trying something different again. Two electors were appointed by the state legislature, each remaining elector chosen by the state legislature from a list of top two vote getters in each congressional district. In other words, basically the voters would choose their electors in the top two out of each congressional district. The state legislature of Massachusetts would then pick the one of the two. And, you know, nine times out of 10, I will bet you that they opted to choose the person that had the most votes, if it was that academic. But interestingly enough, Massachusetts maintained their creativity in trying to do something different each time. Now, New Hampshire, each elector was chosen by voters statewide. However, if no candidate won a majority, then the state legislatures would appoint from the top two candidates. So, in other words, they did it as statewide as well. And in Tennessee, they divided the state into three electoral districts and named three persons from each county in each district to elect an elector for each of the three districts. So in other words, they really boiled it down to the counties and allowed the counties to kind of select the people and then boil it down. In other words, nominate. You had, you know, certain amount of positions. This actually seems like a very good way to go for congressional districts. Now, just remember that when we look at, because I already covered this, when we look at apportionment, I did this, I believe, on Monday. When we look at apportionment and the Electoral College, how many counties out there have 30,000 people? If it's 30,000 people. Now, if it's voters, that number goes down even more. So because we didn't have a standard on apportionment, that way we don't have a standard on the electors, but I'm just throwing it out there that you would have many, there would be 1,000 plus counties out there that would have their own elector. It would end gerrymandering significantly. Now, when we look at Tennessee divided, we just covered Tennessee. So in the 1800 election, and this is really historic, that the 1800 election was historic because it took a long time. I forget how many votes, but it took, 60, 70 votes. I mean, there was a lot of different votes to actually determine the outcome. And so what they did was the 1800 election for choosing the president actually forced the 12th Amendment. So in 1800, Maryland and North Carolina divided into electoral districts with one elector chosen per district by the voters of that district. In other words, they've kind of followed what Virginia had been doing. And then here's the interesting thing. Kentucky, basically state divided into two electoral districts, and half of electors were chosen from each of the districts, the two districts. In other words, it was kind of like a half statewide vote. In other words, it wasn't a fully statewide vote, but it was half statewide. Now, in Rhode Island and Virginia, Virginia changed their position, and each elector was chosen by the voters statewide instead of having the electoral districts. In Tennessee, they divided the state into three electoral districts and named three persons from each county in each district. So in other words, Tennessee did the exact same thing. And you got to remember, Tennessee was kind of a new state, right? Because I believe, yes, this was their first election, or in the last election in 1796. That was their first time up, and this is why they created these districts and then nominations, and then they kind of down-selected that way via election. So after the 1800 election and all this turmoil, Thomas Jefferson ends up winning. Congress then in 1803 passes the 12th Amendment and has it ratified, which means that things changed significantly, but not in choosing the electors. There was only one shot at choosing of the president and voting, and then if it didn't get done, the choosing of the president would go to the House of Representatives. Now, in 1804, after the 12th Amendment, each out of the following, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, New York, South Carolina, and Vermont, each elector appointed by the state legislature, so now it grew to six states, in choosing instead of, I think the last time was five. And in 1804, the following states, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Ohio, their first appearance in the presidential choosing, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Virginia, each elector chosen by voters statewide. In other words, it was everybody's name was on the ballot statewide. Now, in North Carolina, Maryland, and Tennessee, the state is divided into electoral districts with one elector chosen per district by the voters of that district. The state is divided in, now this is Kentucky, the state is divided into two electoral districts and half the electors are chosen from each of the district. And then in Massachusetts, not to be outdone in changing their process again, two electors chosen by voters statewide, one elector chosen by congressional district in a statewide vote. So in other words, they use their creativity once again. But how many elections? Now, this is four presidential elections. Five, actually. Five, this is the fifth presidential election in 1804 that changed each time. In other words, this begged and proved that there was really no standard in how the electors, how we the people chose our electors. In some cases, we weren't even allowed to choose our electors. Folks, you should be pissed off. You should be fuming that the parties, the Republican and Democrat parties, are the ones choosing your electors. Let me ask you this. Go look at how your electors were chosen in the last presidential election. This is nine times out of ten what happens. The parties have these conventions, and you're not privy to this because you're not a participant and a member of the party. You vote the party. You blindly accept the party control over you, but you're not a part of that party, so they don't really represent you. You just give them your vote. So, but they're truly not a representative because you're not a part of that. You're not a citizen of the party. But the party is actually the ones that choose in that convention. They nominate who they want and they choose the electors. Tell me how this is constitutional. Tell me how this is a representative government. This actually proves that we have more of a party form of government than a representative government of the people. And how did the parties get there? So this is kind of why we are going down all of these different years and how it migrated and changed. Now, it went on and on, but in 1808, this is when Madison was elected. And so in 1808, I want you to understand that Madison did not run a campaign at all. He didn't even get out, you know, at all to, you know, face the voters once. He spent $0 other than postage in mailing to those electors of the state, because at this point in time, the electors were kind of like the same people, either being appointed by the state legislature or so forth, and he didn't see a radical change. So he sent letters to all of the electors to say, this is what I'm going to do as president. You know, I'm very focused. I'm not going to campaign, but this is what I'm going to do. He was very pragmatic, and he got elected, or I should say, his electors were chosen, and he was chosen as president. We, the people, voted for those people who were going to vote for Madison or vote for the Republican Party, whatever. I mean, Madison was the epitome. Well, he was the Republican Party. He was the candidate. And they don't even show us who all the candidates were, whose all names were showing up on these ballots. The question is, how did they know whose names? As a matter of fact, the electors, I don't think they had candidates. In other words, I think the electors in the very beginning, they, you know, people nominated other people. You didn't actually say, I want to run. You were nominated. And then they had all of these different people. So getting into the boiling it down, I'd love to distill that process too, folks. And as a matter of fact, this is a job for Keith Broders, because I want to say this. All of this information was dug up by Keith Broders of the Constitution Club. You've heard me ping and, you know, promote the Constitution Club before. I've had Keith Broders on this show. He is he's like a dog with a bone when it comes to trying to find something out. I mean, he just doesn't give up. He digs and digs and digs. I love the man. As a matter of fact, he's in many ways, he's a better man than me. And I'm so thankful that he took the time to do this. I don't want you to think that, you know, I did all of the research on this. God bless him for doing some of this stuff. And so in 1808, he found all of it in Wikipedia. And as a matter of fact, once you find one, it's easy to find the rest of them. But in 1808, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, Massachusetts, New York, South Carolina, and Vermont, these seven states, each elector was appointed by the state legislature. Then in New Hampshire, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Virginia, these six states, each elector chosen by voters statewide. In other words, it was this big ballot and people voted for so many electors. You had the freedom of choosing out of the 20 or the 30 or whatever, this many. That's all you could choose. And then in Kentucky, the state is divided into two electoral districts and they've, you know, kind of maintained that half in each. And then Maryland, North Carolina, and Tennessee, the state is divided into electoral districts with one elector chosen per district by the voters of that district. I still believe that that's the best way, that we actually have an electoral districts that we actually create and that we, the voters, choose, because this is not representation in the House of Representatives or in Congress at all. This is about who is going to represent the people. Remember, we're a Republican form of government. And I'm okay with, actually, if you want to divide it and use the congressional districts, but I prefer actually creating elector districts like they did in Maryland, North Carolina, and Tennessee, and how Virginia actually did this originally. But they realize that that becomes a lot of work for the state legislatures to identify both congressional districts as well as electoral districts. Now, in 1812, each elector was appointed by the state legislature in 9 states. So this concept of the state legislature was growing, and now in 1812, we had Madison again. And then in New Hampshire, Ohio, Pennsylvania, in other words, they were changing it up so much going back and forth in the choosing of the president. And I believe that the outcome with with George Washington, John Adams, and then Thomas Jefferson and now James Madison, I don't think the voters really had any qualms. I mean, these men became logical. Yeah, this guy's the father of the Constitution. the father of our independence, the father of America, George Washington. John Adams was one of those that, because he was the vice president and was integral in the Continental Congress and articulating the concept of a republican form of government, that our law is our king. I mean, these men were just easy to, choose. It didn't hurt anybody's head. Now today, Trump, Obama, I mean, look at how, these names and people are being inflicted upon us. Not so bad with Trump. I mean, Trump has not been as nearly as tyrannical as Biden, Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Carter. I mean, Trump is more kind of like a Reagan where, he's not great, but at least he's not reigning tyranny. Now, moving on, as we kind of go through this, and what I want to do is I kind of want to skim down and let's take a jump, because in 1816, we actually had James Monroe, who was now going to be running for president, another framer, a guy that was at the ratification debates in Virginia, a guy that was the Secretary of State under James Madison, a man that actually was ready to, and during his first presidency, he actually repatriated blacks to Liberia. He secured Liberia for black Americans, for freemen in America, and repatriated them back to Liberia because it was just not palatable. At this point in time, blacks were losing their suffrage. Now, let me go back. If you didn't know this, in what was it, 1788, or 1788, the very first presidential election, black freemen in every state except for three were able to vote. Moving past the 1800s, states started playing shenanigans and actually started taking the suffrage away from black freemen. Huh. Now, this wasn't done by the federal government. This was done by the states. And even the northern abolition states started denying the right to vote for blacks. Why? So, and this became one of those, hot key issues for abolitionists and so forth. Anyway, as we kind of, look moving forward, here James Monroe did some things that really, I think people love this because it was giving, helping, secure a future for black freemen where it seemed like it wasn't going to be a bright future for those black freemen in America. And this is why Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, is called Monrovia. It was after Monroe. Anyway, so in 1816, when Monroe was selected, each elector was appointed by the state legislature. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 states again. And each elector chosen by statewide voters in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then in Kentucky, Maryland, and Tennessee, they kind of did the exact same things. So as we move on, and what I want to do is I want to go past Monroe because Monroe was unanimously selected almost in that 1820 election. So when we go to where Monroe is going to step down, now who's going to become president? Well, that was going to be John Quincy Adams. Now, we have Alabama, Connecticut, Indiana, Massachusetts, Mississippi, New Hampshire, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Virginia. 12 states. Now, and Virginia's kind of joined these ranks where the state legislature determined the outcome. In other words, the state legislature went and overreached their constitutional authority, and they chose the outcome and chose the electors. Now, in Delaware, Georgia, so in other words, it seemed like this level of tyranny was growing in the states, if you see what I'm saying. In the very beginning, it was kind of all over the place, but slowly but surely, the state legislatures saw an advantage of controlling it. Keep it small, keep it all. And so as this went into the 1828, this is how it went. Delaware, 1828. This was after John Quincy Adams was selected by the state legislatures. In 1828, the state legislatures, who then decided to really make a significant change. This is the big change, folks. Each elector appointed by the state legislature was only done by two states, Delaware and South Carolina. Then in Maryland and Tennessee, the state is divided into electoral districts, so they kind of maintain that. Then in Maine, two electors chosen by voters statewide, one elector chosen per congressional district by the voters of that district. Anyway, that made sense to me. That's a process that makes sense. I could be okay with the state saying that's how we're going to do it, because that's kind of how Congress is being fitted, right? So anyway, one elector chosen per congressional district by the voters of that district, remaining two electors are chosen by the other electors. In other words, the electors chose the two for the state. If that makes sense. Instead of the state legislatures choosing, the state legislatures allowed the pool of electors that were chosen by the voters to choose the other two out of the field that didn't get selected. Now, that was done in New York and New York alone. So all the other states that were in the Union in 1828, which was quite a few, each elector chosen by voters statewide. So in other words, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six states out of how many? 20 some odd. So now all of a sudden there was this huge switch over to statewide voters for the electors. Okay, so in other words, there was this huge ballot in 1828 in most all of the states that listed all of the different electors. Now, see, here's one of the problems I have with this. What happens if all of the electors are coming out of the city and winning a popular vote out of the city? This actually allows the city and population centers to control who the electors are. In other words, the people throughout the state lose their suffrage in the choosing of the president. So even though they were adopting a process to give the voters the ability to choose their electors, still not a direct democracy, it was close enough to start stinking like one, to where population centers could actually start controlling the outcome. So in 1832, there was Maryland to maintain the electoral districts. South Carolina was appointed by, this is where it really started settling, right here in 1832. Maryland maintained the electoral districts. South Carolina, each appointed by the state legislature, the electors were still chosen in South Carolina. All other states, we're coming close to 30 states now. All other states in the Union were actually chosen voter-wide, in other words, statewide by the voters. Population centers were starting to move in. And in other words, this is how they started obtaining the outcome that they found favorable. From 1836 to 1852, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's a total of 5 presidential choosings. Five presidential elections. That it was the same. South Carolina appointed the electors and all other states were actually, you know, voter wide for choosing the electors. Again, the president's names were never on the ballot. It was electors that were chosen by the voters. Now, in 1856, this is when the Democratic Party and the now resurging Republican Party from the ranks of Madison and Jefferson began taking over and creating a primary process. And this is where the birth of the primary began, to where they started down selecting who was going to be available on the election, on the general election, which is not as fair. Well, we'll get into that the next time we talk about electors. But to be clear, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.